Tonight I'm in Virginia Beach, obviously Virginia, and Paul Rodel, the IVS Oral History Project, and I'm in the house of Ronald R. Sauer, or otherwise simply Ron Sauer, who served in Laos in an interesting position because it was in education and also agriculture too. The years 1965 through 67. So much for that for an introduction, because then I can get the heading all taken care of. I'll put this aside and ask you the first question I already told you we were asking folks, and that is for you to tell me, us, something about yourself, some of the things that created the young Ron Sauer, who by 1965 had been kind of pointed in a direction to join something like IVS. And that's sort of your own free-form association, so that we're not leading you to anything in specific, but generally when and where you were born and what your parents were like or how you were raised and all of the influences from any place that influences can come that formed you as a young male. Going off and beginning to look at the world. So now I get to shut up. Okay. And you get to fill up the tape.
Okay, I'm Ronald R. Sauer. Most people call me Ron.
Uh-huh.
I was born in a suburb of Denver, Colorado in 1942. Oh. Shortly after that, moved up to north central Colorado, where my dad spent his whole life involved in agriculture. My mother was a housewife until her three children were out of the nest and away, and then she spent about 20 years working as a food store worker, as a cashier, and that type of work, keep her occupied.
You mean like a grocery store?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. It was a Safeway store.
Yeah, okay.
Needed something to keep her occupied.
Well, yeah.
There wasn't anything to do at home anymore.
Didn't have any of the ankle biters or larger to chase after anymore.
She got tired of the clubs and the things that people were doing. So, anyway, I came from, I guess, a very supportive family. They always were willing to put up with whatever I was interested in, and I got their full support when I decided to go to Colorado State University, where I majored in landscape and nursery management, and graduated in 1965.
I was really interested in a job there.
You were?
Yeah, I really was.
I've got some real good contacts out in the kitchen. I'll show you. I'm supposed to be there the 2nd of August for a big, they're going to endow a chair for one of my professors. I will not be there, but I'd like to go. Yeah. I was interested in joining the Peace Corps, but felt there was too much paperwork involved, and met an IVS recruiter on campus, and really, really found it a fascinating, it seemed like something I wanted to do, so.
Who was the, do you remember the
name? I sure don't remember, I'd have to, I mean, if I saw it, I'd...
You'd say, I think that's familiar, but mm-hmm. Yeah, but not, yeah.
Yeah. I don't know, it wasn't Dwayne Hammer, but it seems to me I had some conversations with Dwayne Hammer at one time or another along the way. And I don't know if he ever worked for IVS.
I don't know.
I know he was USAID.
But
I don't know if he happened to be at the campus or something and spoke to me or whatever. But
so what was it about IVS that clicked?
I don't know, it seemed probably a little bit more unique.
Oh, really? Yeah. Okay, yeah.
You know, it was... probably the reason I went into the Marines instead of the other services. It was just a little bit smaller, probably a little bit something that appealed to me. I don't know.
I've had other people talk about the size, you know.
And there's certainly the factor of getting to know people that you're working with.
You know, yeah.
Something, organizations are so large that...
Uh-huh.
But...
That's like why some people like to go to a small liberal arts college rather than the big state school.
Right. I wanted to travel.
Mm-hmm.
I hadn't done a whole lot of travel, and that was certainly a way to do it, and
mm-hmm.
I really haven't stopped since.
No, I know.
I mean, it's the first trip is the hardest, and then after that, it just seems like it's getting easier and easier to go pick up and pick up and go.
Although still expensive. Well, what was it about the Peace Corps that also attracted you?
I think probably travel, doing
travel
something.
Travel mostly.
Probably, and well, also to help people. I mean, I've always found that a very, very important thing. In fact, I think I'm still a benevolent person.
Yeah.
I think through my activities at my church, and I mean, my wife works there. I mean, that's but even before she worked there, I'd been involved in a lot of different phases of it.
And as a youth too.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Well, I've always been pretty. I mean, I've run astray, but I've always been pretty close to the church. You know, it's something I've always kept up with. In fact, I'm really excited. We're getting involved in Habitat for Humanity, which I think is just wonderful. And it's just another small way you can help other people.
So this is a continual evolution, rather than
I hope so.
But I mean, the IVS experience was not just an aberrationist, but it's part of the whole pattern.
I think so.
Yeah. Well. You know, sometimes it wasn't.
Right.
for some people.
Right. Yeah. Well, I know that some people have had very bad experiences with various organizations, and that was not the case with me. I think it was wonderful. I've met some fantastic people, and I've learned that there are cultures other than ours.
Yeah.
And they're valuable. They're valuable.
Yeah.
And some of the nicest people I've ever met are not Americans. Although there are some nice Americans.
Sure, yeah. No, I mean, that's a lesson that not many people learn. It's what makes, now that it's going on, watching the Olympics so difficult for me, because it's all, you know, Americans screaming for USA, USA, and just...
There are other countries there.
Yeah, the chauvinism is just amazing. But, okay, so You're raised up, and what did you say your father did again?
With agriculture. He worked at a processing plant for alfalfa.
Oh, maybe you didn't mention that.
Well, I said he was with agriculture, so
his
whole life really was around agriculture. Eventually, he was managing the, I don't know what you would call it, sort of like an actuary at a bank where you go out and buy crops at a fixed price, hoping that you can get them and make and process them and
futures.
Make a profit. Well, futures, right.
Yeah, kind of futures market.
You're hoping that you will make money on it, and if you guessed wrong or the weather has changed,
you'd be in
maybe
trouble.
It's not so good.
Yeah, but...
And heading the maintenance and, you know, buying trucks and whatever the thing needed.
Yeah, that's a tough job. You really have to know what you're doing.
It's tough physically, too. It's, you know.
Because you got to go around so much?
Yes.
Yeah. But I was thinking of all the internal knowledge, because a farmer has to have the same knowledge too. But this guy's got the whole bank. He's riding on his shoulders.
Right.
So that's kind of hard. Mm-hmm. So anyway, and how big was the town when you grew up?
Oh, I grew up in the country.
Yeah.
But the little town of Milliken probably still does not have a traffic light. It was built, hopefully, as resort property around 1900 by the Great Western Railroad. And as the article goes in the Denver Post years ago, the streets from east to west were named after wives and girlfriends of the railroad workers. For example, as you come into town, you have Alice, Beulah, Cora, Dorothy, Ethel, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And the newspaper concluded with, ironically, the town's main street is named Broad. not spelled that way, but
yeah.
But it's a very small town, and my nephews are going to school there now, an elementary school, and so my brother is still in the area. My sister does not live that far away from there. I'm the only one that's sort of
drifted off.
I don't know, I got sent to Virginia enough times that it seemed like that's where I was supposed to live.
Yeah, well.
You know, IVS first brought me up to
Harper's Ferry.
Harper's, well, that's not really Virginia, but it's close. And
yeah, it's close enough.
And Washington is,
yeah,
it's sort of close too. But I was sent down here 3 times with the Marines also.
And so Susan was telling me how many.
Kind of used to this area and like it very much.
Yeah, no, this is nice here. Let me ask you, so you get a recruiter that comes to campus, and this is Colorado State, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's the agriculture college of the system. This is the one
that's
Fort
one
Collins, isn't
yes,
it?
Yes, uh-huh, yeah, that's one of the colleges there.
But I mean it's for, yes, but it's noted for its agriculture section.
Well, it used to be the Aggies.
Yeah. Yeah,
that was the name. But
yeah, that was one of the reasons why I was kind of like attracted to the school,
because
I like to do history and combine it with studies of plantation and economic change and stuff like that. Rural change, so kind of rural sociology, but historical and
right,
you know, getting into the crops. And I thought that would be perfect kind of history department for me. Unfortunately, they didn't think so. But anyway, enough about me. More about you. You say, and I've heard this from other people. You come to Washington. You get the Harper's Ferry for a few days. Right?
Mm-hmm. I don't remember how long, but
yeah.
Most of our time was spent with the language, the Berlitz Language School, and other classes. I mean, to learn the other things that we needed to do and processing. You know, the things that we didn't ever have to worry about, passports and. You know, because that was all taken care of for us. That was that was nice.
So in Washington, how long was it?
Seems to me we were in school about 3 weeks for language and probably another week or a few days with the other things involved, and Harper's Ferry. And
Was there specific cultural training along with the language stuff, or was that, you know, stuff that you kind of pick up from the language?
My impression was, and I cannot remember any classes, but we had four, I believe, Laotians who were our instructors at Berlitz, and we were encouraged to spend our off-duty time with them.
Oh.
So we learned an awful lot about the country just by being with them so many hours a day and then spending time with them after hours.
Yeah, okay. Well, that's good.
Yeah, it was. It was.
Yeah, because I know that some of the earlier volunteers really didn't get very much at all.
No, I thought it was a good opening.
Yeah, no. What I'd heard of people who just kind of like get sent in a plane and they just say, well, now we're going to drop you off here. Goodbye. You know, here's a book on how to speak the language. they had learned a lot by 1965.
I think we were really people who took it seriously, and I think almost everybody did, really could have gone into that country, and it would have been a little bit tough, but I think they could have survived language-wise.
Mm-hmm.
Because when you're really forced into it,
mm-hmm.
It makes a big difference. My first year, I wasn't forced into it. There were so many Americans around there, and we did have translators available, but this wasn't the case in Luang Prabang.
When you say the first year, just for the sake of the tape, that's the Dundalk School in Vientiane.
National Education Center.
Yeah, and there you were teaching English? And
no, I was actually... No, that was...
you raised your eyes like, oh, I thought...
No.
That was in the evening, perhaps.
That was the second year. It was a voluntary
basis. Oh, that was the second year.
Year was basically agriculture.
Okay.
We did the experimental gardens and taught various methods other than the Laotians for the students to learn, and then had experimental gardens for the farmers if they wanted to come in and see how different plants would behave with different cultural methods and also different crops that we wanted to introduce.
Yeah, you know, I mean, slow head, because we had looked at the photographs of your plots, and I confused that with the second assignment.
Yes, I wasn't teaching English there.
Yeah, no. Yeah, because I had confused the two sites. To backtrack just a wee bit, just getting your impressions of the trip over, because this is, after all, the first time you really traveled.
Mm-hmm.
And impressions of the trip over, and your first impressions of this new country you're being introduced to. If you remember some of the first sights, sounds, and impressions that you had.
I was so excited to go to Tokyo, first of all,
mm-hmm.
because I've always been a fan of Frank Lloyd Wright. And okay. Incidentally, one of his houses is in Virginia Beach.
Oh,
it's for
really?
Sale right now, if you're interested. It's only about...
yeah, I bet.
It's less than a million.
Really?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's a bargain.
Yeah. Well, you haven't seen the house. It's nice, but I don't think it's worth that much.
Really?
Anyway, I wanted to see the hotel.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And fortunately, I did get to see it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been torn down since then. You know, so that mm-hmm. was a one in a, you know. And also getting to see Hong Kong, because, you know, places like that I'd seen in pictures, and it's so different to be able to go there. But I don't think I was prepared to land in Vientiane.
Really? Why not?
Well, I don't know. It just really looked like the end of the world. I mean, mm-hmm. it just, everything just seemed so vintage.
That's a nice choice of words. What do you mean?
The aircraft, the automobiles, and I guess that was my first experience with mildew. You know, the buildings get black if they're not washed frequently. I found out that shoes turn green in your closet if you don't
bring them out every once in a while,
or have a heat, you know, a heated mm-hmm. closet, a light or something in there. But it just I don't think I was really quite prepared for it being as, I don't want to say primitive, because that's not a fair word, because in many, many respects, the Laotians were very advanced. But not up to the standards I was used to living with.
No. The material culture was not up there.
Right. I mean, we had everything we needed.
Mm-hmm.
But still, I guess I felt it was... Well, I just had grown up with much more, and I wasn't used to giving it up.
Yeah, yeah. Especially not overnight.
That's true. That's true.
Especially if... and they might have told you about that during training. But there's
a difference
between the mind and the gut.
They gave a lot of emphasis on culture shock. And
they had by that time.
And I think that was very good, but still mm-hmm. until you do it...
Yeah.
And I've been to other places since then, mm-hmm. and the experience in Laos made all of these others much easier.
Yes.
I mean, when I went to, I was going to say the first time I went to Korea, but actually both times I went to Korea, my living conditions were much humbler than they were in Laos, but,
really?
Well, I didn't live in a tent when I was in Laos.
Yeah.
And winter in Korea is considerably cooler than in Laos, although it can get cold in Laos.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think that experience...
But not as cold as Korea.
Well, no. No, that's very true. That's very true. But
Tokyo and Hong Kong were not a culture shock?
I don't think it was a culture shock, because I was just amazed.
Okay, yeah.
I had been to, you know, cities like Los Angeles and places before with, you know, that had a lot of people, but never a place that had as many people as Tokyo or Hong Kong. And mm-hmm. I was just pretty much dazzled, because we were in the shopping districts and places where, you know, I couldn't afford to go shopping.
Right.
Well, I could then better than I can now. Let's be honest about it. But I don't know. I think it was just total amazement. But when I got to Vientiane and knew I'd be staying there for a while, I thought, ooh. But even at that, it was exciting.
Mm-hmm.
It was different. Mm-hmm. It was different. I mean, I've always been a sort of a plant nut, and be able to see all of the different things that were growing there.
Mm-hmm.
And growing so well, you know, because they just, they're supposed to be there.
Mm-hmm.
And,
right.
You know, frangipani and things of that nature. I was bedazzled.
Yeah, that's right. I hadn't thought about it, but yeah, you don't actually need a nursery and the glass enclosure and all the heating for them. You know, and how for someone who is a plant nut, I would never bother to go and, you know.
See. My counterpart at Vientiane had basically a nursery around his house. He was bringing all kinds of plants in. In fact, he would go searching for them because, you know, there are orchids and uh-huh. other neat things that grow in around there that he could bring in and grow there.
Sure.
And I think I did a little bit of that when I was in Luang Prabang. I'd have some coconuts sprouting in pots in my yard uh-huh. and orchids and other things that I could find and bring in there. And a lot of plants around the house. It's uh-huh. just, it was something that really interested in me. So that was just pure gravy.
Oh yeah, but the idea of someone who really loves plants, mm-hmm. and here we have to go to, you know, special places
right.
to find.
I don't know if you
growing.
Saw. I've got bananas growing out here.
Yeah, no, I was.
Now,
that's
now,
one
these
of the
are
things
the,
that I
these
like.
Are,
about
these are small this year because we had a bad winter. I mean, they have to be dug up and mm-hmm. put away for the winter. But I grow bananas here because it's fun, because you can do it.
Yeah,
you're not supposed to be able to. So. it's fun to take bananas and, you know, share them with people. They're not as
mm-hmm.
they don't say Chiquita or anything on them, but they're edible, quite edible.
Short varieties?
Yeah, they're finger bananas.
Yeah. Oh, those are much better than Chiquitas anyway.
Could I tell you a little story about Dave St. Louis? Can we?
Sure.
Do you need to pause this or just?
Well, if you don't want.
No, okay. I just. One day I came back, this was when
pausing
I...
Pausing is only if you're,
oh,
if
okay.
you might have to say something that you wouldn't want him, you know, to know that you've been staying
oh.
around.
Hey, he might not like this, but I...
Oh,
anyway,
okay.
No, anyway, one day
that's
I came,
all. I mean,
I came
yeah.
back and it seemed like every apartment had a hand of bananas
uh-huh.
on the doorknob. And so
huh.
we started asking what's going on and found out that Dave had put these on all of the doorknobs. And
that's
so,
gifts
yeah,
for
so
people.
So the question was, why did you buy all these bananas? And he said, well, I went to the market and I was arguing with this lady and she had a price and I had my price and I guess I don't speak the language that well, but I was arguing really, really hard with her. And so she told me in essence that I was a cheapskate. And I said, well, what happened? And he said, well, what I did was bought a whole stock of bananas thinking I was bidding on a hand of bananas, and she said I was a cheapskate because I wouldn't give her very much money, so he brought all of these bananas back and gave them to me. Now the price probably was really good for a hand of bananas,
yeah.
but not for the whole stock. I mean, that kind of stuff went on all the time.
Yes.
I don't think he'd mind if I
shared that. No, not at all. I'm sure not. No, it was only if it was, mm-hmm. you know, a negative comment or something that might have been personally embarrassing, but you might, you know, that sort of thing. Yeah, we were before talking about the dangers of half knowing a language.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Well, sometimes it turns out to your advantage, in that case it did,
yeah, big time. And for you too.
Oh yeah.
And for everyone else, because
you all the bananas.
Had some free food. Unfortunately, the poor woman in the market certainly would have had a different respect for the Westerners out there in the school. They know the language and drive a hard bargain.
That is something that I brings to mind, that something I didn't quite understand about some people, that there were a lot of Americans that you would run into and that they probably worked for USAID, and I'm thinking more wives, dependents,
mm-hmm.
that probably didn't want to be in the country in the first place, but they were absolutely afraid to go to the marketplace and buy things.
Mm-hmm.
And it was wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
They had great produce. I mean, I was a little bit hesitant
oh, yeah.
to buy meat or some things that I thought should have been maybe refrigerated or whatever.
Yeah.
But
but food and cloth and all kinds of things. It was actually fun to go do that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the IVS people pretty much took advantage of that. I think they tried to immerse themselves in the culture much more than other Americans did. And I kind of liked getting in with the people.
Yeah, no. Well, that's the whole, well, it's one of the points of the whole program. Certainly you had the language ability to do it.
Well, I had my problems too with the language.
Well, I mean, but they didn't have anything.
Right.
Most likely.
Right.
You know, and that's terrifying. Yeah, because you don't know what anyone's saying and can't make a coherent response yourself. You told me before we started that you really studied the French language,
mm-hmm,
as well. And you said that it was helpful to you in your work. I wonder what you meant by that.
This was in Luang Prabang.
Oh, this is later, not at Dongduk and
No, not at Dongduk. It wasn't necessary. Although there were French people that I associated with, you know, those teachers that we spoke about that lived in those houses there.
True French teachers.
Yes.
French teachers of French, not Laotians who would have remembered French from the colonial days.
No, these were actual French citizens.
Mm-hmm.
When I went to Luang Prabang, I was, I guess, the only American. Well, Dave St. Louis was up there, eventually working on his programs. No, it wasn't Dave St. Louis. It was Peacock. You can look that later.
Peacock.
Yeah. He and I were probably the only two people, Americans our age. You know, everybody else was older. But it seems as though almost everybody we had to deal with, any of the functionaries in town or whatever, spoke French. And they felt it was necessary to do, and I'm talking about Laotians too, that were, you know, police officers or whatever else.
Mm-hmm.
It seemed as though they preferred to speak French than their own language when doing official business. And of course, as I mentioned, I dealt with the people at the hospital occasionally.
Yeah.
And that was a run by a French staff. And the other people around there. It was necessary, and so I took French lessons the whole time I was there.
But it's a carryover from the colonial days. A mark of distinction?
Well, it was their official language for government business.
Okay, so
a lot of the stuff was written in French.
As well, okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I never really got very good at reading the Laotian language. I mean, small things I could make out, but buildings, if they had a title, was probably in Laotian and in French. And signs and paperwork and everything else. So it was just there. English was not very useful to me.
No.
Except, I did teach about 8 to 10 people in the evenings.
Right.
Just as
well, of course. Then your knowledge of English was helpful as a teacher. But
right.
Well, I was wondering about the prestige of the language because, folks who were in Vietnam just. I'm telling you this, and you can tell me how different or similar your experience was. That folks who were IVS Vietnam, when they knew some French, and could speak to an older Vietnamese, they would immediately get this recognition from the older Vietnamese that you are educated, and you are a properly civilized person because you know French.
Right.
Okay.
And I think, in some respects, it was the educated Lao's way of telling the people around him that I don't have to speak our language, I can speak French with these people. This is something that you're not going to understand because you didn't go to school.
So it's not only utilitarian in a job sense, but there's the intellectual prestige, and there's also the social
leveling
between classes as well.
I think so, I really do.
Yeah, so it's a threesome kind of thing for you. And you're learning French immediately catapults you up into a category
of
different kind of phalange.
I needed it for survival.
Yeah, well, you might have looked at it as survival, but it also does these other things.
John Perry was the area coordinator for USAID while I was up there.
You mentioned him, yes.
And his wife was a French woman.
Uh-huh.
He married her in France, World War II, and she taught French. I mean, she taught me. Very early every morning at the USAID building up on the porch on the second floor, we'd have our coffee and French lesson the morning before I'd get started on the day. And that was kind of a fun way to start the day.
And had you had any French before?
No.
Mm-hmm. Oh, so this was just picking this straight up.
Right, I had Spanish in high school, and
okay, so at least one romance language.
Yeah, there's not a whole lot of similarity except the sentence structure and thing. There's a lot of things that happen the same way that way, in both those languages. So,
yeah, and you had mentioned Peacock.
Mm-hmm. Jean, I think his name was.
Yeah, that one's. Yeah, I'm going to pause for just a second. I have to waste tape. Not exactly sure why Betsy got crossed out. It could be for my own calculations here. We were talking. I turned the tape back on when we were starting to talk about your housing.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to get that on so that you could have that on tape. In terms of the housing that... Whoops. No, we were, one of the questions we had on the form in an earlier incarnation was about the housing arrangements that you had while you were volunteer in both of the places. So if you could tell me something about your day-by-day living.
At
both places, actually.
Yeah, in Vientiane at Kilometer 6, it was an apartment, a small apartment. Nice screened porch, a very small kitchen and bath, and there was a sort of a living room that had kind of a divider in it, and the other half of it was a bedroom. I mean, it was it was open, and I'm sure it was not open because it was a divider just to keep your eyes out. I think it was probably because of air circulation to let air go through there, because it seems to me there was a window air conditioner unit or something that.
Sure, that way you could come over.
Could come over there, right.
Mm-hmm.
The house in Luang Prabang was not air conditioned, but with ceiling fans and keeping the house pretty much open, it was bearable.
Mm-hmm.
I found out very early on that the electricity wasn't all that great in Luang Prabang, and if you didn't turn your fans on in the daytime when no one was using electricity, and you got home at night and turned them on, they wouldn't do anything because there just wasn't enough oomph to spin them.
Yeah.
So what you would do if you came in late was get a broom and spin your fan and then go hit the wall switch and it would continue.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Kind of priming the pump on the fan.
Right.
Okay, yeah.
It was a very nice house for one person. It had had three bedrooms and... a big living room kitchen type affair without any, there wasn't a sink or a stove or anything. I think I had a refrigerator in there. I had a kind of servants quarters out back.
Uh-huh.
Couldn't afford servants, but had servants quarters, and there was a stove back there so I could do some cooking. And but it was a nice house. The owner was an army, I think he was a major or a lieutenant colonel, a Laotian, who had a house next door which was much less than the one I was living in, but he owned it, so he was collecting rent, and his two of his wives lived in the house next door.
Mm-hmm.
So they looked after, made sure I took care of it.
Oh yeah.
I had a the water in town was not very reliable either. So I had a big tank up on a tower.
Yeah.
That whenever the pressure was adequate, I would fill that up.
Mm-hmm.
And then I had gravity to give me water.
Mm-hmm.
The house did have a hot water heater, which was wonderful.
Which is unique.
Yeah, it was wonderful.
Wow.
And I had a refrigerator that ran on kerosene, which I thought was kind of neat too.
Yeah, yeah.
And it worked.
Yeah, but who did the cooking? Did you?
I did. Yeah. Of course, I spent a lot of times going to the little Chinese cafes. There were all these little soup kitchens all over town. And it wasn't expensive.
Mm-hmm.
Frequently, I'd go have some duck eggs and whatever else for breakfast, and and have a light lunch in the evening. Just hit a soup kitchen or something.
Mm-hmm.
It's probably no wonder I lost a lot of weight while I was over.
Yeah, but it's still good food.
Oh yeah, it is.
Yeah. And now it might have been a little difficult in Vientiane at kilometer 6, but at any point either there in Vientiane or later in Luang Prabang, did you consider possibly staying with the Laotian family?
No, I really didn't.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know why I didn't think of that.
Okay.
It's funny you mention that, because I've been to Japan a couple times with the military.
Uh-huh.
And I've often thought it would be wonderful to go stay with an Okinawan family.
Uh-huh.
That, especially one that didn't speak English. I think that would be great.
Yeah.
But no, I never did think of that.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
I guess maybe I valued a bed too much. Maybe I was creature comforts.
Uh-huh.
'Cause a lot of the houses I was in, just, you know, they slept right on the floor.
Uh-huh.
I remember once I went out to some kind of remote village for some celebration, and the area coordinator said, "Do you think it's okay to go?" And I said, the people assure me that it's okay to go. They told me when it was unsafe to go out somewhere.
Uh-huh.
I mean, they took very good care of me. They said, "It's okay." So he said, "Go enjoy yourself. Let me know as soon as you come back." This little obscure place I was brought into to meet some people.
Uh-huh.
But they left me standing, and I was kind of curious as to why. And someone said, "Well, they're looking for a chair." They knew someone had a vacant chair that they could bring so I could sit down, because they didn't think I should sit on the floor. And I didn't mind doing that.
Uh-huh.
For limited amounts of time.
Yeah, especially because it was only a visit.
Right, right. You know, I did stay with some Laotian people in, just, you know, for several days when I was down in Vientiane, but
uh-huh.
Their house was very Western. I mean, they
so
they had everything that I, you know, would have expected in a house. But no, I never did really think about living with a family.
Okay,
it's a unique. It's probably a good concept.
Yeah, some people would occasionally do it. It wasn't too common,
mm-hmm.
that I could see. I know that it was more common in my own Philippine experience, mm-hmm. because there the material culture was much closer to the American, so we could easily do it.
I don't know, but I think almost everybody in IVS had assigned quarters of some sort.
Mm-hmm.
Some were much better than others. But, you know, I guess if someone didn't want to live there, they wouldn't have to. So
mm-hmm.
I really
mm-hmm.
don't know what the policy was. I had never considered. They said, "This is where you can live." And I said, "Okay."
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, I don't know if there was any policy that would have restricted. But, you know,
there were policies restricting your mobility.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there were some places it was absolutely stupid to go, and yet people did it anyway. And
I talked to one person who did it and got caught and got kicked out. So that's why that made it even
there's one
extra stupid.
One young man whose name shall be left out, who traveled from Vientiane up north somewhere. He wasn't supposed to go, but I think there was a little bit of a rescue mission to bring him back, and his mom happened to show up at the set just about the same time, an unannounced visit. You know,
his mom?
Yeah, I mean, to have a a mom show up, you know, IVS volunteer's mom show up is kind of, I think, kind of unusual anyway. And
highly.
They said, are you so-and-so's mom? And she said, no, he's my son.
Uh-huh.
She was very opinionated.
Wow. She yeah. let it be known.
Yes. I think it was very unusual to have family come over there. We did have some family show up in Washington, which was nice for, you know, the little
final
ceremonies
goodbye.
We had, mm-hmm. little things of that nature, and got to meet some of those people. But for family to come over there was, I think, a little bit unusual.
I've never heard of that.
I think she was the only lady I was aware of.
Yeah, that is truly unique. excuse me. You mentioned a couple of interesting points. The one is that there were areas where you could not go. But more important, maybe, is that you said the Laotians were taking very good care of you.
Mm-hmm.
So in other words, telling you even if there was a place where you could go, if you shouldn't mm-hmm. on that particular day. Who were the folks who took care of you, and why did they?
I don't know. I think probably the counterparts, my Laotian counterparts, students, because we would take, occasionally we'd go out for an outing or something,
uh-huh.
and there were some waterfalls and other things around Luang Prabang especially that were nice to go to, and there were times when they said, it's just not a good time to go, and then we'd probably hear that there had been some sort of military activity in the area or whatever.
Just kind of making sure you didn't walk into something.
Right. I think they were very solicitous of of my health, really.
Yeah, and why weren't they?
And then there were times, come on.
Yeah, right. Yeah, and then they couldn't
and
be
then,
held
and
back.
And as I said, you know, I'd have to talk to the area coordinator if it was a place that was questionable, and he'd say, mm-hmm. well, what do your friends say, He said, I have nothing that says anything is going on there, but, you know, I don't always have all the information.
Yeah.
So let me know when you get back.
Yeah, right. yeah, thanks, boss.
Yeah.
But what... Why do you think that the Laotians were caring for you like that?
I would hope. I would hope it's because they thought we were doing something valuable.
Uh-huh.
I truly believe we were.
Uh-huh.
Even if it was something as simple as teaching a volunteer English class in hopes those people would hope that they might be able to get a better paying job working for the Americans, or whatever reason,
uh-huh.
or a lot of them had the dream they wanted to go to the United States.
Some may have made it.
Oh, I'm sure. So I think it was a two-sided thing. They saw it as a way to advance themselves, but I think they may have recognized that it was good for the country, too.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I think for the most part, the volunteers I knew were very unselfish of their time. You know, they were, well, let's face it, we had a lot of stuff we didn't have to do. I mean, you know, we didn't have televisions, and we, you can only see so many subtitled Thai movies before you overdosed on it.
Kickboxer sort of things.
That brings me to a point. I saw in a theater the Hitchcock classic, The Birds,
mm-hmm.
and it was the language was Thai, and but I saw it in Laos, and the people thought it was a comedy. I mean, that's kind of a serious movie to me.
The Birds?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. I mean, especially when they're starting to peck and attack and everything, they thought it was really quite funny. And a couple of weeks later, I happened to be watching a ghost movie. This car crashes and the ghost comes out and he goes, with his tongue sticking out and everything. I laughed. They thought it was serious. So, you know. But no, I think they liked our presence, I really do.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't feel any animosity. And in fact, I think any teacher now would give a whole lot if they could have students as dedicated as the ones that I had.
Mm-hmm.
Because they knew if they goofed up, there were plenty standing in line to come in. And I cannot remember a discipline problem at all, ever.
Mm-hmm.
The kids were great.
Mm-hmm.
They were great. You know, they were all studying to be teachers, and I think they were serious about it too, because they knew that they were going to go out and work. You know, and some of these places they were working were pretty rustic.
Yeah.
Because we went out and visited some of the schools and did some little rehab projects, little things that we could do to help make the buildings better or furniture and things. So they weren't going to have an easy life.
Yeah.
But
no.
But I think they were.
They'd really be out in the boonies.
Yes.
Yeah.
But in a lot of cases, it's where they grew up. You know,
mm-hmm.
and they would be going back home.
Mm-hmm.
And they would be looked up as a leader of the community, as a teacher.
Mm-hmm.
So.
So big investment, big personal investment.
I think so.
Yeah, mm-hmm. and so I don't know though if it's just taking care of you because they thought you were doing something good for the
mm-hmm.
country, or even good for them. I think they probably also had something.
Maybe they didn't want a scandal.
Yeah, what are we going to do with this dead body here?
He bumped off another teacher.
Yeah. No, I think they probably just liked the teachers.
Yeah.
You know, especially because, as you said, they, not only yourself, but the others were unselfish with their time. You know, and how often does that happen anywhere?
But they would ask some funny movies. They'd see these, or funny questions. They'd see these, like a Doris Day movie,
mm-hmm.
and all glamour. And they'd say, "Do you have mud in the United States?" Well, of course we do.
You wrote that in your yellow thing, and I was,
I mean, they'd see these movies and think that everything is perfect here.
Mm-hmm.
And you try to explain to them some of the poor areas of the United States,
uh-huh.
the Appalachians and,
uh-huh.
and various places, and the problems in inner cities.
Uh-huh.
They don't believe it. Now that there are these movies, these gangster rap and all these kind of movies, maybe they've been exposed to some of the seamier side of our country. But they really thought everything was like Doris Day, you know. Everything
wow.
is pretty. You know? Nobody has an old car. Everybody's, you know.
Nobody's hungry.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah, well, yeah. Now they're probably terrified to come.
I really had a hard time convincing some people that we do have mud here. Lots of it.
Yeah, right. Well, you could always ask, well, how else do you think we would grow our food?
Yeah, it's like, about 3 decades too late to use that one.
Well, yeah. How come?
Well, I hadn't thought of it now. Too late to go back.
I was thinking, well, what's different about Laos now that yeah. wouldn't work? But yeah.
Well, they've been exposed to a lot more too. So.
Mm-hmm. Oh, sure. Yeah, you were really one of the first cultural influences. The French folks that you saw in. This would have been back in Vientiane. What was their attitude toward you American, young American teachers?
I have always found the French arrogant. And some, many reasons, I wonder why they are.
Mm-hmm.
They're very unwilling to speak English even if they know it well. Yet they don't tolerate mistakes. In their language, they're very, almost vicious about that.
Mm-hmm.
I felt in some cases that I was an annoyance to them, because I was taking away some of their thunder, and I think it's probably because we were IVS anyway, we were much more common, much more like the Laotians than the French were.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we didn't mind getting down and getting dirty. I mean, that's not a problem, and I don't think the. I just Yeah, that's all I can really say. I think the French probably found us an annoyance.
Okay. So it was rather cool in the relationship between the... probably polite enough for the sake
of... In Long Prabang, the one notable exception would be Dr. Chevalard and his wife, Mimi. They were they were very nice people.
Uh-huh, okay.
And I don't know, maybe because Mrs. Perry was French.
Mm-hmm.
But they were...
And it was... What was her husband's name?
John
Perry.
Perry. But they were very congenial, very nice people. I liked them. I grew to like them and their kids very much.
Yeah, yeah. Now, just to pause for a second.
Sure. Trying to think if there's something else with the French that I was going to mention.
Something else knocking around?
I don't know. All right.
Okay.
If it comes, it comes.
Yeah. No, I just found that very interesting when Bob had that to say about them. And I didn't know that they had hung on for so long. But indeed they had, you know, because I was used to in Saigon, you know, the U.S., even 54, 55, trying to get the French out as rapidly as possible, was I guess they were able to hang on a bit longer up in Laos.
Well, they actually had, I guess it was a garrison in Luang Prabang. I think his name really was Cote Vie, was the actual, the commandant of that little compound, the one I called Bras de Fer. I think his name really was Cote Vie. And I think they were training Laotian military. I think they were in an advisory capacity.
Oh, okay. Oh.
And it was a... That plus the French hospital, they ran the hospital.
Yeah.
There were, you know, of course, the Laotians working there, but the French really
as the administrators and things,
administrators and doctors and mostly, I think some of the nurses and lesser
even.
They were Laotian.
Oh, okay.
They were Laotian. But that and the there were a couple. There were a few French people bouncing around town too. I think the manager of the hotel, a local hotel, was French.
And a few expats.
Yes.
Yes.
Except he was pretty young to be an ex, but...
Well,
it could
be at any time, you know.
What can I say?
There's not an age threshold for that.
Yeah.
What about any other expats while we're on this and before other things? Any missionaries who might have been Americans that you would have known at the time?
I don't know what nationality the Rolfs were. They they were really nice people in Luang Prabang. Seems to me that, I don't know if this would say anything.
Oh, the ones who
did
spoken
that,
Lao.
Yeah, they were really a nice family.
Uh-huh.
I think they're the only people in town who had a fireplace. They were clever.
Well, who publishes this? American Council of Learned Societies, ACLS. So, so who knows? Well, no. If they had an ACLS grant, they were probably American national.
Christian and American Missionary Alliance.
Yeah, yeah. There was that alliance that was active in both Vietnam.
And Mr. Rolfe, Cornell.
Okay, he's probably...
He was probably American.
Probably American.
Yeah, he and his family were nice.
So they were...
Really nice.
They were kind of academic as well as a little bit religious then.
Yes, they weren't proselytizing.
Yeah.
They weren't trying to go out and
grab
me, you know.
No, well, a lot of them wouldn't necessarily do that.
Yeah.
If they were associated with languages or hospitals and the like.
There was a semi-loony, I think she was French by marriage, but she was Russian by birth.
Mm-hmm.
Very, very interesting character.
Mm.
I think she had to leave the country for something she did. But she was really a piece of work. She showed us a picture once. There was a gecko on her head. It had fallen on her head, so she ran and got her camera and stretched her arm out as long as she could. And some minor thing. She ran afoul of the government and had to leave.
Yeah,
I don't think it was very serious as far as I'm concerned. But
Well, you never know how governments.
One of those things you can't do.
Yeah.
And it might be something that she did that the French told her to go. I don't think it was the Laotians told her to go.
Yeah.
I think the French government probably said, you're out of here.
Yeah, well, that's too bad. What about the Operation Brotherhood? Was that around in?
I guess I
probably not in Vientiane, but maybe up in.
I guess I heard about it, but didn't know a whole lot about it.
Okay, you didn't know those folks.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, because I thought that the total, let's say expat foreigner community is kind of interesting, and how they related.
The other foreigners that I. And one of them that I traveled to Cambodian with were members of the VSO.
Yes, the British group.
Yeah. And I don't know a whole lot about their work, but I think mm-hmm. they were pretty well thought of by the Laotians.
Yeah.
And I think they were, respected by the American community, too.
Mm-hmm.
I just knew a couple of the young guys who, actually, one of the women that they knew, we met her in Cambodia, and she traveled with us for a while in Cambodia.
Mm-hmm.
It was an interesting happenstance to meet, someone from England in Laos.
Yes.
I mean, I expected French people. That was not a surprise.
Right. No, that's, if you didn't meet any French people, there'd be something wrong.
Right.
Yeah, well, I mean, even in my assignment, there was a guy from Japan
mm-hmm.
who was with their own equivalent of Peace Corps. And he had the misfortune of first being assigned to the Bataan Peninsula.
Mm. Anybody remember him? His parents?
Yeah, well, he had to use all of his martial arts for a while to protect himself.
Right?
Yeah. So he was anxious to get out of there. But we've touched around a lot of things. But what about the school out in Dundalk, and then later up in Luang Prabang. If you could tell me, you've said some things, but a little bit more on your actual work at the school.
Well, first at Dundalk, I had two people who assisted me greatly with
mm-hmm.
preparing. Well, I would prepare lesson plans, and then we'd go through, and they would do the translations.
Mm, okay.
So a lot of times they were actually doing the teaching. I was just monitoring what they were doing, listening and seeing if there was any point that I might somehow be able to make
uh-huh.
actual teaching. Mm-hmm. And then Mr. Pitya was older. He's probably much younger than I am now. he seemed older.
Yeah.
And
he was senior in that position.
He and his wife and kids had a little Laotian type house right on campus. They had a little mm-hmm. fence around it and nursery, their own nursery and their garden and stuff. But his primary job was to make sure all of the plots were being maintained. The students mm-hmm. actually did the mm-hmm. the various gardens.
Yeah.
And they made some money from it, but it was basically a learning thing. And as I mentioned, the experimental plots to show, it was kind of like the extension service of the
right,
universities.
No, yeah, I was going to ask about that.
Yeah, Mr. Pitya would, we'd work on those, and I'd try to explain the different things I wanted to do instead of slash and burn type thing.
Right.
Fertilizer plants, different ways, of different spacing, different things that you can do to change yield. And he would actually make sure all of these things were put together, and he served as sort of a guide whenever anybody came in to look.
How often was that?
Whenever they wanted to, really, but
mm-hmm.
I'd say a couple times a year people would
mm-hmm.
would drop by.
Mm-hmm.
But he could get one of the school Land Rovers and go in and buy the seeds and things of that nature. And, no, he was very valuable to me there. When I went up to the teacher training school in Luang Prabang, didn't really have an interpreter there, but that was not that much of a problem because I was learning. I was
mm-hmm,
my second year there. A lot of the same things, the plots,
mm-hmm.
Got a little bit more involved with animals to. Growing some something that they can use for protein,
mm-hmm.
Other than peanuts, I guess. Yeah. Incidentally, that was a very difficult word to get the kids to pronounce properly.
Why? Well, with
peanuts?
What would they say?
Penis.
Oh.
You have to say nuts. Why? Just trust me on this one. It was.
I think they would have enjoyed that translation. Any young women in the class?
Oh yes.
Oh well, then that might have been a little.
This one was
a little
problematic. Everybody called her Elizabeth Taylor. She was cute. I don't think she looked like Elizabeth Taylor, but that's who they called her. And she, she'd say that, and I'd say, "You've got to pronounce it this way. Why?" Just like a little girl. Why? Anyway, maybe they knew. Maybe they're just.
maybe they're just testing me.
But and as I said there, I had even less to do socially, so I spent a lot of my evenings teaching English,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And that was, it was, I think, very valuable, rewarding. I liked it very much. These people, there was a policeman and a couple school teachers, a secretary, and one of the girls, her father was a Frenchman who lived in, I guess he was an expatriate who was living there in town.
Mm-hmm.
So I had no way to, I could tell people, you can't be a student of mine. They were just, a bunch of young people, so.
And pretty much everyone was welcome.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And
sure.
My house was certainly big enough that I could do that without any problem. So it was,
yeah, because you've described that.
Yeah,
that sounded.
I think I had a couple sofas and a few chairs that I could pull up, and it
mm-hmm.
was quite adequate for teaching classes like that. Light
mm-hmm.
wasn't as bright as it should have been. That was another victim of that. We had a step-up transformer, a voltage transformer, and fluorescent lights, and it wasn't that satisfactory. But,
It's better than kerosene lamps.
Mm-hmm. That's true. That's true. You don't need to wash a fluorescent bulb every day.
That's true. Yeah, or trim the socket,
right,
or whatever.
Whatever you do to it.
Yeah. But you did mention that this gets back a little bit earlier, that you would be informed if such and such was not a good place to go and things like
that.
Well,
that was only if I was planning. They wouldn't just come up and say, "I don't think you should go here." But if I mentioned.
If you mentioned
we were going to go somewhere, they say, "Oh, okay, let's go." Or
right,
that's not a good idea.
Yeah, especially in Luang Prabang. Did you go out into the countryside to work with farmers at all, or was it pretty much just at the school?
That school, and then up in the mountains, there was an IVS rural development people
mm-hmm.
that were up there. I can't even remember the town right now. I guess I could pull out the big map. But anyway, I'd go up there occasionally because there was a school there. And
oh, okay.
And see if there was anything I could do